How about this? Maybe there's something wrong with that metaphor, because notice it has to do with planes and transitions. It's an inherently dualist metaphor. How about if we say there is no inside and outside. There is no with or without. You just use what you've got. Whatever works should be used. I spent time in India and visited all these people and so forth and so on, and I just became convinced that unless you were predisposed to believe in this stuff, that it would never carry you where you wanted it to. And one thing about psychedelics, you don't have to be predisposed. It doesn't work for those who believe it works. It works for those who think it doesn't work. Then one last point, and then we'll go on. There's a story, maybe some of you know this story, of a man who lived by the side of a river. And he wanted to cross the river. So he practiced a siddhi of levitation so that he could walk across the water. And it took him 40 years to perfect this siddhi. And finally he could cross the river. And Buddha was preaching in the neighborhood. And the guy came to him and he said, Master, look what I've achieved. I can walk on the water to cross the river. And Buddha said, yeah, but the ferry costs a nickel. And that's the thing. I think we're not going to be able to replace this tool without wasting so much time in the act of replacing it that Armageddon will catch up with us. I think we have to humble ourselves so thoroughly that you have to admit that you can't get where you want to go unless you form a partnership with somebody whose idea of a good time is growing in a cow pie. And if you're willing to partner up with this humble, humble member of the ecosystem, then you and it can fly to glory. Have at it.
Any other women in the room who want to take mushrooms, if you're pregnant, there's a chance that you could then carry an accredited woman out.
Yeah, I wouldn't recommend, especially in the late stages of pregnancy, doing anything that is going to wildly perturb you. And you know, LSD was discovered in the act of trying to produce better drugs to induce labor. So that's excellent advice. Honor the fetus. Yeah.
As a biologist,
yeah. Well, the true and honest answer is, how the hell can you find out when they won't let you do research? It's totally insidious. We don't know. We don't know because they will not allow the research to be done. This is one of the reasons why I say that you should stick with shamanically sanctioned plants. Because we know, for instance, that people have been taking psilocybin in the Sierra Mazateca of central Mexico for millennia. They don't show blindness, tumors, miscarriage, madness, cataracts, whatever. That's your human data for that. But you go to, let's talk for a minute about something like ketamine. Nobody knows. Nobody has any data. MDMA. Seems to be tremendously effective in facilitating interpersonal stuff. That's a psychological issue. Chemically, what kind of data do we have? You know, 6 years worth of data gathered under duress. So to be safe, stick with the things that are sanctioned by human use. And then in some more enlightened future, we will explore these synthetics and find out just what the parameters are. Yeah, finish up.
With the natural synthesis, mushrooms or peyote, because it's a natural thing, needed doses are at not going to hurt you.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying take things which have been sanctioned by human usage. I mean, how about a plant like Strychnos nox vomica? I mean, you're dead in a minute and a half. And it's a beautiful, wonderful plant. Why did it kill you? Well, because it's jammed with strychnine. No, it's nothing about its being a plant. It's about having a repeated history of human usage. That's what sanctifies it. Yeah, the lady in magenta.
First of all, I'd like to
reply
to the woman who's sitting over here. I deeply respect your position there because many times in my own search for consciousness, I've wanted to not have to depend on an external catalyze my growth in consciousness. But I propose that you think about one thing, and that is, I studied plants for the last 23 years, plants as medicine. And what I noticed is that there is a particular co-evolution that happens between the plant and the human. And so what I started taking for granted at one point that the mushrooms were going to catalyze the same kind of consciousness that they always have. But not only do the biological climatic situations determine what is going to happen to that mushroom and how it's going to affect your body, but I think that all species are changing consciousness at the same time. So what the generations of mushrooms might have given me years ago when I was 18 years old, that whole species as a whole might be prepared to teach an entirely different, more evolved lesson at this point. And so I just can't catch up a little.
Mm-hmm. That's really an interesting point. I mean, it never occurred to me, but somebody brought it up to me. They said, have you noticed that the trips are changing? And once you do ask yourself this question, it does seem to be so. And I don't know whether that's a deep assertion. I'm not sure exactly what's going on there. For instance, this goddess thing, I don't think people gave the goddess a thought in the early 1970s, late 1960s. Now, people have, you know, some of the least likely people report intense encounters with the goddess. So is it amplifying the general mindset of the society, and so there's more goddess stuff there, or I don't really know. It's a very interesting question. There are more questions than answers. I mean, this is definitely wide open stuff. Yeah. Yeah.
You discussed our descent into hell, which certainly makes sense. It's a believable description. And you suggest the use of psychedelics of psilocybin as an antidote to that. But I had trouble seeing a cause and effect relationship as far as what our use or more widespread use might lead to in terms of veering this path.
We're trying to restore the relationship of ego to the other components of the psyche that existed as recently as 12,000 years ago. The ego has become a deadly growth in the historical societies, exacerbated by the phonetic alphabet, monotheism, modern science. This is like you're getting sicker and sicker and sicker as you lay these things on. And so the idea is that if we could restore the original diminished role of the ego that it had for that period, however long it was, that we could begin to solve our problems. Because the problems which face us, put very simply, are going to demand sacrifice. And sacrifice is what the ego doesn't want to hear about. I mean, when you go to somebody and say, look, to save this planet, we're going to have to redistribute income radically. That means everybody in this room is going to have less. We're going to have to honor a whole bunch of cultural positions that we previously just were going to bulldoze over, and so forth and so on. So it's the diminishing of ego by any means necessary that lies to getting any grip on our problems. I mean, if we continue as we are, I think we have probably less than 30 years before life is irreconcilably screwed up. You know, nobody believes that the future is rosy and wonderful. I mean, if you go to the people at the World Bank and the IMF and these people who are straight, you know, suits, all of them, they have a set of curves which would stand your hair on end. When they propagate the curve of population, the curve of toxification of the environment, the curve related to the ozone hole disappearing, you see, you know, it's finished sometime in the next 50 years. They don't talk about this because they don't want to panic the vast numbers of people who just go to work and raise their kids and pray somebody smarter is doing something about all this. But they don't believe there is any kind of normal future. And I don't either. I think we're going to, that it's business as usual is not on the menu, folks. We're either going to go into an era of immense resource scarcity, regimentation, governmental interference in our lives, tremendous propagandistic efforts to make us do one thing or another, or we're going to pull the plug on scientism and its stooges and the institutions which feed it. Capitalism is an interesting problem, more easily discussed now that communism is out of the picture. Capitalism is as anti-human a philosophy as you can possibly conceive, because at this very moment, we should be consuming less, manufacturing less, selling less, transporting less. And what's the battle cry? Free trade everywhere. What does free trade mean? It means my right to come to your country and sell the most outlandish junk you've ever seen, and you will have no right to turn it away, because in the name of free trade, crapola has to go everywhere. It's really, see, they try to tell you that capitalism and democracy are not at variance. Actually, the whole Marxist-Leninist socialist thing was a side dish. The real life and death struggle is between capitalism and democracy. Democracy says everybody has an innate worth that must be honored. Capitalism says those who die with the most toys win. You cannot reconcile these two things. And nobody wants to talk about this. We're still having the party over the fall of communism. But, you know, you go to the Soviet Union or the former areas of the Soviet Union and you see that what it was a deep freeze for traditional culture. In Kyrgyzstan and Turkmenistan, people are basically camel husbandry is what's going on. Now, with communism on the rocks, McDonald's will be there in 5 years, and Kmart will be following close behind. So I think we're coming to a great crisis of fundamental, our relation to our own fundamental institutions. I'm not anti-capitalist. I think capitalism needs to sever its connection to materialism. This is, again, why virtual reality is interesting. You sell things made of light, not made of beryllium, metal, brass, steel, and wood, but light. We've got all the light we need, but we have to stop making things out of stuff, or we're not going to be around to tell the tale.
In order to get anywhere, we have to have a major shift of values.
Yeah.
You're suggesting that a way to shift our values is to take a classic psilocybin, which I don't disagree with, but your model has been that everybody in the culture participated in this and were able to shift their values simultaneously and so to cooperate. Are you suggesting, is that the necessary outcome in this case?
No, I think that, you know, revolutions are made by percentages. if 15 or 20% changed, then the example would spread. You see, we are not, psilocybin is the easy way to awaken. You know, take a psychedelic plant and have an experience and get your act together. But the future is full of sledgehammers. It's not going to end with a whimper. It's going to end with a series of thuds and bangs. It could begin almost any time. I mean, we could get a hot, muggy day in Mexico City this summer, and a million people would die. This thing in Los Angeles is a wake-up call. It is going to get uglier and more chaotic and more crazy. There is going to be more starvation, more fascism, more dictatorship. It's unless we do something, until we do something. And it can, how bad is it going to have to get before people say, you know, we're doing something wrong? You know, people dance on the Russians, but you've got to admire people who have the guts to say, we did it entirely wrong, 100%. I mean, can you imagine in this country to being able to do, say, you know, I mean, it may be coming. This character from Austin is a peculiar item in the mix. You know, I mean, I for years had a fantasy speech, which I always imagined that I would somehow end up giving, but it's the speech where you say, my fellow Americans, you have been lied to, screwed, and abused by these two criminal parties for 100 years. And your only hope is to overthrow the Republicrats and create a decent world to live in. Well, no Republican can make that speech. No Democrat can make that speech and be credible. It has to be somebody who wasn't in bed with either of those forces. So I'm not at all pleased by who apparently will bear the mantle. But on the other hand, if change is what we need, then it's probably not going to be a candidate that you and I can embrace. It's going to be some oddball. So, you know, we have to recognize it when we see it coming. Yeah.
A couple of things. First of all, it seems to me an attempt to place the spatial or temporal context in which you put this experience, you have to realize what the assumptions are that go into that. We don't even know what this is.
No, we don't know what it is.
Try to place it into a temporal spatial mode. And it seems to me that it serves us better to leave the question open and have the experience and let the experience tell us what it's about and where we need to go.
Yeah, the great thing about it is it can talk.
Secondly, I'd like to ask a question about time wave zero.
Good for you.
when I first saw you talk about that, it was on a team that was made in Santa Fe, I believe. And I was fascinated by it, and I watched it closely, but as it got to the end of the tape, when I started getting interested in what the significance of a zero crossing was, the tape stopped. So I'd like to, I mean, it seems to be a decreasing function of time, which meant that a zero crossing had some singular significance, but I really wonder what, in real terms, a zero crossing is, time wave zero.
Well, probably half at least in the room haven't the faintest idea what this question is about. I've stayed away from this because this is the personalistic stuff where I've created a certain model of reality based on a new way of looking at time. And I don't want to go into it too much tonight, but I want to suggest something to you tonight, which is that, you know, at the very beginning of this talk, we talked about mutation and natural selection, and that's the Darwin's insight was vast and deep, and what he offered was an explanation for how rainbow trout come to be, monarch butterflies, redwood trees, herds of elephants, so forth and so on. What it doesn't address is us. We are the weird bird on the block. I mean, yes, we're some kind of monkey, but when you stand us next to our nearest relative, it's very, very clear that it is not a very near relative. It doesn't look like us much, certainly doesn't act like us. What's the deal with human beings? And I think that, you know how all these religions, these Western religions, have built in this idea of the end of the world, and they're always running around expecting the Messiah or something. And this, to the scientific mind, is just the final proof of the pudding that these people have water between the ears. Because science just says, you know, that's just ridiculous. I mean, but I wonder, I mentioned just a minute ago these curves that when you propagate them into the future, everything leads to the unimaginable, and it's all within the next 50 years. So I sort of think as human beings, as analogous to iron filings on a piece of paper, and you shake these iron filings out of a salt shaker or something, and there they lie, randomly arranged in heaps. Well, then you come underneath the paper with a very powerful magnet, and lo and behold, these little iron filings coherently arrange themselves into this beautiful double mustache pattern, which I'm sure you've all seen. Well, I think that there is an enormous punchline to the historical process that very, very few people suspect, and that what history is, it's what happens to an animal who falls under the influence of a kind of strange attractor, and that we are being pulled into a well of transformative intentionality. History is not pushed by the casuistry of war, migration, imperial dynastic families and stuff like that. History is pulled toward an unimaginable something which is continuously trying to mirror itself in us. This is why these Egyptians said, you know, I don't know what it is, but I just think we should really build a big, simple building. They say, I don't know why, but I'm going to enslave 50,000 people and do it, and don't ask me why. And this is, and you know, this is the same force that reared Chartres Cathedral. This is the same force that created the space shuttle. We are in a relationship to an unseen something which we keep trying to image with our mythologies, our religions, our technologies, our epiphanies. And I think that it's not so far away, that it isn't 10,000 years in the future. It is sometime in the next 50 years. And that this is what history was for. You see, history is an incredibly peculiar and brief phenomenon. I mean, viewed from the point of view of biology, it's less time than it takes for a new species to emerge. I mean, let's call history 25,000 years. You know, in frame one, you're chipping flint. In frame two, you're hurling an instrument toward Alpha Centauri. Like that, this happened. Well, what's happening? It's that mind itself is being pulled out of this creature, and it's being given hands and languages and symbolic systems in order to image the unspeakable. The unspeakable, I call it the transcendental object at the end of time. It casts, and it's in another dimension. It's in a kind of super space. And what it casts into history is the enormous shadow of its immanence. This is what straight people call God. This is what all these visionaries are raving about. It's that when you sink beneath the surface of ordinary causality and mundane ho-humism, what you discover is this enormous transcendental object, which you could call it, you know, the sacred heart of Jesus, or the flying saucer, or the philosopher's stone. It's all of those things, and much, much more. It's not only stranger than you suppose, it's stranger than you can suppose. And it has called us out of animal organization over a 25,000-year period. We hang in the balance, and then we meet it. And we're going to meet it. That's the light at the end of that birth canal of transcendence that I referred to. And now I see that our song is sung, our time is done. Thank you very, very much for turning in. In the interim, I think that it's worth taking the time for everybody to just make a very brief, very brief statement about. You don't have to say who you are if you don't want to, but you can say what you're hoping for, or why you're here, or what your agenda is, just so that if it turns out we're 80% shrinks, or, you know, 80% ceramicists or something, then we turn it that way. And those of you who are undercover, please stay undercover so you don't alarm anybody. Especially me, right? So why don't we just start and go across in some reasonably logical fashion, which, yeah. Well, that tells you what you're worth, doesn't it? Oh, true. No, let's not record it so people... And also, I had at one point thought I would be an art historian. That was one of my real obsessions. So I had enough art history to be trained in, you know, recognizing the evolution of motifs, how one artist passes on techniques and conceits to his students or his imitators, and all this art historical stuff. And I also had been very interested in Jung. And none of this seemed to explain the content of the psychedelic experience. I would get in there and say, well, how come I'm not seeing A, archetypes, and B, things which somebody else, you know, I don't know, Dali, Ensor, Caravaggio, Bosch, somebody should have seen this stuff and gotten it down. And there didn't seem to be a trail through the history of Western art of the presence of this dimension. So then I thought, wow, is it that nobody knew about all this? I mean, Bosch would have given his right arm for a sheet of blotter, I would think. So it became for me like a mystery. Where is this stuff coming from, and what does it say about our humanness? Yeah.
I've read and heard where Bosch was used as somewhat of a guinea pig by the alchemists of his time. They were experimenting with him.
Well, there's a lot of ink been spilled over Bosch because he is such a startlingly radical painter in the context of his time. Many of his conceits were picked up after his life, Peter Bruegel the Elder being the foremost exponent of it. He may have been an alchemical guinea pig. Frager, I think, wrote a book called The Millennium of Hieronymus Bosch, in which he wanted to suggest that maybe datura use, that there was a cult called the Brotherhood of the Free Spirit, which practiced ritual nudity, which begins to sound something like the orgies we talked about last night. It was a cult of printers. And it may be that the Garden of Earthly Delights was actually painted as an altarpiece for a congregation of the Brotherhood of the Free Spirit. But this is all pretty murky stuff. It's hard to get back to Bosch. He didn't leave any written records. We have his birth is recorded in the parish church where of the village where he was born. We know he was born sometime around 1450, died in 1516, but the details are pretty murky. Well, not to belabor Bosch. So what I thought would be a reasonable way to do this morning is to take the most extreme psychedelic case and experience and describe it and talk about it a little and then see what issues that raises. Because my experience with this stuff has led me to the conclusion that in a way it's to be thought of, this other dimension is to be thought of like a mandala, and different psychedelic compounds and generously different kinds of yoga and different kinds of techniques of all sorts land you in different parts of this mandala, but that what you're always trying to do is get to the center of the mandala. And it's simply my bias, my opinion, but I think the center of the mandala is probably the DMT experience for a number of reasons. And so I thought it would be interesting to talk about it this morning. First, let me talk about it physically. DMT is an indole hallucinogen, a tryptamine. And it's produced endogenously in the human brain. This is very interesting. Very few psychedelic compounds are produced in the human brain. We don't know what DMT is doing there, but it means essentially that we all are subject to arrest on a technicality because we all are holding a Schedule I drug. It's sort of the ultimate catch-22, where if all else fails, they just say, well, you were holding anyway. The interesting thing about another interesting thing about it is that it's incredibly rapid in its onset and in its disappearance. The whole trip lasts about 15 minutes. This makes it a tremendous tool with which to challenge the critics of our position. Because if somebody wants to rise up in righteous wrath and condemn psychedelics, then you say, well, you have tried them, haven't you? And of course, they never have. It's like scientific denunciations of astrology. I mean, scientists love to denounce astrology, but find one who can cast a natal horoscope and I'll give you a hen's tooth. DMT overcomes this objection. The entire experience lasts 15 minutes. So you say to the critic, you know, you're not going to experience it, and yet you're going to carry on a pogrom against it. You won't invest 15 minutes to checking out what this is about. You know, what kind of scientist are you? So it has that social efficacy. Now, the fact that it is the strongest of all hallucinogens, at least if there are one stronger, please keep them away from me. I mean, I don't think anybody needs to get higher than that. I certainly don't. I mean, I've at times come out of those places and said, this stuff is illegal. You know, it breaks cosmic law. Of course, then Tim Leary told me that cosmic laws are only local ordinances anyway, so it didn't really matter. Okay. Well, good question. Yes, it's the commonest of all hallucinogens in nature. It occurs in many grasses, Phalaris tuberosa, Phalaris arundinaceae. It occurs in a number of leguminous plants, probably the most spectacular being Anadenanthera peregrina, this huge tropical locust-like tree from which the snuff called niopa or ipina is made. That's a tough way to get your DMT, let me tell you, because there's so much cellulose and other crap and corruption in the mix that you have to do like a tablespoon up each nostril. And the technique is you get a bamboo tube or a hollow tube about this long, and you pour in this tablespoon of this stuff, and then you squat down on your haunches and you get a friend, and you put the tube up your nostril, and then the friend blows with the full force of his breath, blows this stuff into your head. Well, you fall, it's like being hit in the face with a 2x4. I mean, it's like you think he kicked you, and you fall over backwards, you scream, you salivate, you get back up on your haunches, and by this time he has refilled the tube for the other nostril. So, and then, after... Yopo, Ipina, Nipa, it depends on the language group, and the Waika, Yanomami, it's also called Vilka in the Carib language. And then after 10 minutes or so, it slowly begins to form up in your head. But, you know, God, your sinuses are in stat for sure. And it's not very pleasant. And the other thing is, it never reaches the blinding transformative intensity that you can achieve with the chemically pure compound.
Orally ingested.
No, no. Good point. If you orally ingest it, it will be destroyed in your guts. It won't work. The Amazon Indians have encountered this problem and created a very sophisticated pharmacological strategy for dealing with this. You've all heard of ayahuasca. Ayahuasca is DMT from one plant combined with another plant which contains a chemical which is called an MAO inhibitor. MAO is monoamine oxidase, and your gut is full of MAO. And its job is to take monoamines, small molecules, and oxidize them into a harmless byproduct, usually indole acetic acid, which can be shunted to the bladder. Well, when you take DMT orally, these monoamines just, these monoamine oxidase compounds just grab onto it and destroy it. But if you take an MAO inhibitor with it, and harmine, which occurs in Banisteriopsis caapi, is an MAO inhibitor, then, lo and behold, it isn't destroyed in your gut. Instead, it passes into the bloodstream, it passes through the blood-brain barrier, which is a very tight chemical filter that keeps the brain from being exposed to toxic materials, but these drugs can cross that barrier. And then what the ayahuasca experience really is a slow-release DMT trip that instead of taking 5 minutes, takes about 2.5 hours. And if you really know your psychedelics and your breath control techniques on ayahuasca, over an hour or so, you can work yourself to a place where you say, Lordy me, it looks just like a DMT flash. And it does, but you've had to do some hard climbing to get there. With DMT itself, Once you push the start button, there's no stopping it. And I think it's worth describing it. How many people have had this experience? Well, so they can somewhat anchor it. It's very subjective, obviously, but I will describe what happens to me, and then we can work out from there. One point that I want to make about these things is that the great strength of the psychedelic possibility is it's democratic. You know, it isn't that people of great spiritual advancement attain these states, or people who have studied under some lineage. It's truly available to everyone. And when I had my DMT experiences, I realized, you know, either I am incredibly special, which doesn't, there's no other evidence to support that, or this is something which can happen to anyone. And that's the more interesting possibility. After all, if it can only happen to very, very special people, then that lets most people out. But if it's generally available, then it's big, big news about the human condition. Yeah.
How the Indians found these complicated ways to use these substances remains a mystery. But how did they find it in the human brain?
How did they find DMT in the human brain? Interesting question.
You mean how did they prove that it crossed the blood-brain barrier?
No, I think he means how did they find that it was endogenously produced. Well, I think they were studying, the group that did this was at the University of Louisiana, Christian and his group, and they were studying fast reactions in the brain. And for fast reactions, you have to look at chemicals that can go through some kind of cycle of structural change and return to their zero point very, very quickly. Their original thought was that DMT mediated attention. I mean, I'm talking to you right now. Suppose there were a loud noise over here. We would all immediately project our mind onto the source of the sound. They thought that that was a neurological function mediated by DMT. Could be, I'm not sure. I suspect it has more to do with the chemistry of dreaming. Once they discovered DMT and began to track it, they discovered that there was a circadian rhythm, means a daily rhythm in its production in the human organism, and that it reaches its greatest concentration in the brain around 3:30 a.m. in most people. Well, this is when the deep dreaming and the high REM states are really chugging. And I suspect, I mean, lucid dreamers may want to argue with this, but I suspect that every night we go deeper places than we can ever speak of. That ordinary dreams are right on the surface of consciousness. Big lucid dreams are an inch deeper. But I think we go 100 feet down every night into places where you cannot say anything about it. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about availability of DMT and for people who can't get Yahe, and I heard you talk about the system of excretion.
Let's make that perspiration. Well, it's
practicality for people who live in the States and can't go to the Amazon.
It's hard as hell to find DMT. And this is a puzzle, because if you look it up in a standard work on organic chemistry, it presents it as a trivial synthesis, much more simple than LSD, which it always presents as quite a difficult synthesis. But when you actually talk to workbench chemists, it's tricky to make DMT. It's especially tricky to carry out the final crystallization. So what you're usually offered in the underground is some kind of muck, which looks sort of like maple syrup half gone to sugar. I wouldn't get near that, actually. It means they they botched their synthesis. What you're hoping for is a white powder. However, in 30 years of chasing this all over the world, I've only seen it as a white powder a couple of times. Usually the synthesis has fallen slightly below that standard, and what you get is a pale yellow powder, sometimes a pale rose or pink powder, and then the real rough trade is orange. And this is what you, if you've seen it, this is probably what you've seen. It looks like orange mothballs, and it has the smell of indole, this very sharp smell, which if you're not a chemist and you've never smelled indole, when you reach in your mind for what is this like, you'll say, well, it's sort of like mothballs. Not quite, but it has that same sharp chemical, you know, and this is what you're going to smoke, see. So a lot of people beef about that and say, well, you know, it's like smoking burning plastic. Yeah, más o menos, but it is a little bit like that. The other objection to DMT that has been around since the 60s is people say it destroys brain cells. There's no evidence for or against this, but I would submit to you, especially the people who are neurophysiologists can argue with this if they disagree, but I think an excellent index for the low toxicity of a drug is how fast it clears your system.